It's inflation and government policy and other issues and the sorts of things that most people ask me about when they find out I'm an economist. Although I must admit that when I start to explain it to them, I can see their eyes look elsewhere for someone else to talk to. But I'm going to start talking about inflation and drift into some other things and out of them again. I have tried over the last 24 hours. I did take a little time off to sleep, but mostly I was worrying about this session, thinking of you. But I tried to remember the questions that people ask me, and what I've tried to do is weave those together in an account that I hope will not be technical, will be correct, will be helpful, will provoke further questions and discussion. And here I go, because I got to leave time, lots of time for you to talk about this. All right, I'm going to begin by just raising some questions about inflation. I think that we are much too upset by inflation, or at least we're upset about the wrong things. I do think that inflation creates a very serious problem for our country, but it's not the one that we believe it is. It might help if we began by recognizing that inflation is not an increase in the cost of living. It's not. Inflation is a decline in the value of money. You say, what's the difference? Big difference, big difference. Inflation is simply a fall in the purchasing power of money. If your ability to earn money income goes up right along with inflation, as by and large it does for most people. Some people's money income goes up faster than inflation, some people's money income goes up less rapidly than inflation, but on average, it goes up right with inflation. In other words, inflation, everybody's gain is somebody else's loss. Because what's really changing is the purchasing power of money. When money becomes much more abundant, its value falls. And that's what happens in inflation. Now, why does that happen? That's a very, very important question. But before asking why it happened, let me just ask what harm it does. I really don't think we think about this. We talk about it. It disturbs me when, for example, my church, we were in our stewardship campaign, talking about how difficult it would be for people this year to increase their pledges. And we said the church costs have gone up for us, and we realize that times have gotten harder for you, so that the church will need more money because of inflation, but because of inflation, you will be less able to contribute. That was sad. And because it came from the clergyman, I didn't want to stand up and say, wrong, 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 but it is wrong. Sure, there are people in that congregation whose real purchasing power has gone down because of inflation, but I don't know any of them. It's a large congregation. Almost everybody I know in the congregation, their monetary incomes have gone up because of inflation. Now, they haven't all kept pace with inflation. I haven't, for example. But the notion that inflation makes us less able to contribute to the church is fundamentally mistaken. It's a weak excuse. Well, who does get hurt by inflation? Well, obviously people whose money incomes don't keep pace with the fall in the value of the dollar. And who are those? And by the way, it's always important to point out that there are other people then necessarily benefiting. Well, I'll tell you one group that's been badly hurt by inflation. Landlords. True, it's really true. That has a lot to do with housing problems in the cities. In every inflation for which we have any records in this country, an increase in the inflation rate has not meant an increase in the rate of residential rents. If you think about it, there are good reasons for that. When the inflation rate steps up, it's difficult for landlords to go in and tell the tenants, hey, you got to pay more rent. It's you know why. The notion that landlords or apartment owners are some kind of vicious ogres who care not a whit for tenants, but all that they're doing is milking rents out of poor people. That's not basically true. And even if, I'm not saying that landlords are noble souls whose sole purpose in life is to provide shelter for the deserving. I'm just saying people who own apartment buildings are an interesting sample of the population, at least with respect to virtue and vice. And even a wicked Simon Legree would not find it in his interest to be raising rents all the time, because the tenant is in possession of a very valuable piece of property, which he can do a lot of damage to if he takes a dislike to the landlord. But there are all sorts of institutional reasons why rents rise slowly. That they do rise slowly is a matter of well-documented fact. And so in a period of rapid inflation, residential rents don't keep up with the consumer price level, and so landlords are significant losers and tenants are significant gainers. Interestingly, the tenants don't notice this. No, they don't. You know why? You think about it. There have been all kinds of studies on this. Because the tenants expect their rent to stay the same. When the price of milk goes up 1 cent, 2 cents, the price of a newspaper jumps a nickel, cars go up, they take it, they grumble, but the rent stays at $200 a month, $200 a month. It's lagging. And then all of a sudden, the adjustment occurs in a big leap that still doesn't catch up. But then the scream. Of course, rent is a big chunk of your budget. When the price of clothespins goes up, you don't notice it. When the price of rent goes up, you do notice it. So interestingly, though on average, owners of apartments are the losers from inflation, the public widely believes that tenants are the losers. And that points to what I think is the principal problem caused by inflation. Inflation causes grievances, largely based on misperceptions, which makes us very angry with one another, and we start making claims in the name of justice, and the sum of those claims far exceeds the capacity of the society to satisfy them. Let me just give you an example from my own life, my colleagues. When I'm sure you've had an experience similar to this. The value of money falls by 10%, and let's say my productivity hasn't increased at all, my value to my employer, measured in money terms, goes up 10%. Now, I'm not more valuable than I was before, but because money is now worth less, my employer gets more of it, he's willing to pay me 10% more, so he pays me 10% more. So what I do is I conclude, aha, that is a long overdue recognition of the 10% increase in my value. As you know, I've long been underpaid relative to my colleagues who really don't do as much as I do, generally goof off. What I'm saying is most of us tend to think that we are under-rewarded, under-recognized. And so when we get a wage increase or a salary increase that is actually due to inflation, we think it's due to our merit. Then we go out to the store and find out that prices have gone up 10%, and we say, blast! Inflation has taken away my well-deserved 10% wage increase. That's the kind of illusion. Anything good that happens to us is due to our merit. And anything bad that happens to us is due to them. I'm very serious about this. I believe that this kind of thing is the principal danger from inflation. It distorts our signaling system. It creates an awful lot of claims of injustice. I might just throw this in, though, as a counter. It also sometimes makes it easier to achieve justice. Of course, you could ask, what's justice? But I'll just give you one example. Justice requires that college professors get substantially lower salaries over the coming years than they have been getting. Now, what I mean by justice, very simply and crudely, is the price that clears the market, that allows room for people who want to teach college to come in and teach college. And the truth of the matter is that we college professors got our salaries enormously bloated in the bull market of the 60s and then the 70s, And there is a much greater queue of people eager and able to teach in colleges than there are positions ready for them. And I think that justice, I'd be willing to defend this, is justice requires that the salaries, the wages of college professors generally come down quite substantially. That will cause some to leave. Good, let them go. It'll open more slots, though, for more people, and education will be better served and all of that. But golly, how do you do that? You know, suppose my dean calls me and says, "Hey, the market dictates a 10% reduction for you next year." Oh, you know, deans survive by not doing things like that. A successful dean is someone who never flaunts the faculty. He needs inflation to do it for him. What the dean does, he comes in and says, "Hayne, you've been tremendous. We value, now you know how tight the budget is, and we have scrounged, we found a 2.8% increase, merit increase for you. Sorry we can't provide a cost of living increase. Meanwhile, the consumer price index has gone up 12.8%, so I've got my, I walk out smiling, the dean's a good guy. He gave me a 10% wage reduction, and that doesn't. That's happening, and you know, so it's an ill wind that blows no good. Who are the real victims of inflation? We got to be careful about that. That's really tough. You know, certain old phrases the retired. Well, some retired and some not. You know, Social Security benefits are now indexed to the cost of living. Of course, many people, though, are living not just on Social Security benefits, but also on some other retirement benefits that are not indexed to the cost of living. So they can be partly keeping up and partly losing out. One thing is clear, but the other thing you can say is that long-term monetary debtors benefit and long-term monetary creditors lose. Now that leads into something that's important to a lot of people, and that is housing and mortgages and the price of housing. And I want to talk about that because this is when news magazines feature what's wrong with our society today, housing is always going to come into the picture. About 22 years ago, I sold a house that I lived in Indiana, and the man didn't have a down payment, so I sold it on a long-term land contract at 6% interest. And his wife just paid that off. He's died in the interim, but his wife paid it off. And I made a calculation the other day that I was getting 0.3% interest over this period. Why? Because of inflation. I mean, in effect, he bought the house at no interest. I myself, when I moved to Seattle in 1976, bought a house with a 9.75% mortgage, and I figured just as soon as mortgage rates came down, I would refinance that. I haven't gotten around to refinancing yet, but I calculated. Now I've been paying. I think I've been paying about 2% a year, real interest, because your real interest rate. The real interest rate you wind up paying is that nominal interest rate minus the rate of inflation, or the rate at which the value of the dollar declines. By the way, let me just say that I am using here the GNP deflator, the gross national product deflator. If you want to ask me what the difference between that is in the consumer price index, which most people quote, I'll be happy to talk to you about it. It's a better one in our time. The consumer price index has a tendency to pay insufficient attention to changes in people's spending patterns that are induced by shifts in relative prices, like fuel versus clothing. It doesn't pay enough attention to that. And it also, a serious difficulty is that it assigns far, far too much attention to new home purchase prices or used home purchase prices. And that when for reasons that I'm going to get into right now, housing prices change sharply. It simply swamps the index. So you may recall a year ago, some of the headlines said, inflation stops. In July of 1980, there was no change in the consumer price index. It was simply a statistical fluke brought about by the dominant influence of housing prices and some peculiar things that are happening to housing prices. But there's a better measure for our purposes. It's called the GNP deflator. Now, what I want to talk about, though, the housing prices. Once again, I think we panic because we don't see what's happening. There's a great deal of alarm. I'm over here. You can see my pretty picture. A great deal of alarm about the housing situation in the United States, both now and in the future. And I think we have good reason to be concerned, but once again, I don't think we should be concerned for the reasons that we are concerned. What happens generally, and let's suppose this is a time series. This is the some measure of general price level, the heavy line, the unbroken line. And this dotted line is supposed to be an index of housing prices. That's purchase price as it enters into the consumer price index. Now, what happens is that when you've got modest inflation, like we had in the late 50s, early 60s, housing prices just sort of keep up. You know, if the consumer price index is going up 1.75% a year, housing prices will rise about 1.75% per year. When the rate of inflation accelerates, as it did late in the 60s, you know, we moved from about 2% inflation to about 4% or 5% inflation, housing prices go right up, tip up too. Until this new and higher rate of inflation has continued for long enough that people come to the conclusion that it's going to continue for a long time. When the inflation, when the now faster rate of inflation creates long-term inflation expectations, when people say, hey, you know what? This 5% rate of inflation is going to last indefinitely. That hits housing prices real hard and real fast. And housing prices take off like this. Now, why? You know why. Look, the economist will give you this technical explanation. He'll say, a house is a fixed asset, and its present value is determined by the present discounted value of the future stream of net earnings. But what that amounts to is this. If you can buy a house at this price and continue paying off the mortgage, essentially, these prices, when in fact prices are going to rise, you got a good deal. You got a real good deal. Get yourself a $300 a month mortgage payment, even though you can't afford it right now, because in a few years you will be able to afford it. And within 10 years, you're going to be laughing at that. Your mortgage payment will be 5% of your income. An upsurge in the rate of inflation causes people to look for hedges against inflation. And the most available hedge for most Americans is a house. So what we did was recognize that buying a house now, this started about 74, 75. All kinds of people became extremely eager to buy houses. And of course the supply of houses can't increase as fast as the demand did, and the price of houses starts shooting up. Then it feeds on itself. What happens is that people look and they say, boy, I wish I bought last year. Houses start increasing in price at 20% a year. And so then what happens then is you get a speculative boom feeding into this, further increasing the demand, and the price of houses will really skyrocket, but it always stops. And it stopped different places, different cities, different times. But in Seattle, this leveled off about a year ago. And then what happened was people had overestimated the speculative increases. They thought these 20% increases would go on forever, so they bid too much, and housing prices start to fall. That's what happened last July. That's why the consumer price index showed stability. What it was just this little dip. And then after that, they'll keep on at the rate of inflation. That is why people say, golly, that house, 10 years ago, it sold for $32,000. And they just sold it for $132,000. And then people will say, at that rate, within 10 years, well, that rate's not going to continue. That rate, this. Now, another thing that gets people upset, then they say, well, not only are these houses selling for these astronomical prices, which I'm trying to tell you are not astronomical. They are prices that reflect the current value of that house as a long-term investment and hedge against inflation. But then people say, not only are those prices ridiculously high, but look at mortgage interest rates, 13%, 14%. Once again, it's an illusion. When the rate of inflation is 10% per year and you get a 13% mortgage, you are paying 3% real interest rate. The state of Washington just took off its 12% usury ceiling. And oh, it was interesting how people were screaming about the greedy banks, the exploitative banks, milkiness and all of that. But in fact, the banks were loaning money at a loss. They were borrowing money at 18 and 19% and loaning it to people. Well, federally chartered banks were loaning at 14%, which they were allowed to do because of an exemption in law. But state banks were just absolutely strapped. And what was happening was that people in the state of Washington weren't able to get any credit. And people would say, that's just terrible. I'm willing to pay 12%, and they still won't give me any credit. I mean, you're not willing to pay 12%. You're willing to pay 2%. You cannot look at a nominal interest rate and pretend that it's a real interest rate. The cure to this way of thinking, the one that I always apply to people when they start screaming about interest rates, I say, you think those interest rates are outrageous? They say, yes. And I say, then why do people borrow at them? And the answer is because they're not outrageous. They're good deals. The lender insists upon a very high interest rate when he expects inflation, and the borrower, also expecting inflation, is willing to pay it. Okay. So when we take account of those things, I think we get the current housing crisis in perspective. What I've talked about so far, it seems to me, is not a crisis. It is simply one of the predictable side effects of inflation. But now, I want to turn, as soon as I answer her question or respond, which is, I want to turn to, I think, real grounds for alarm. Mm-hmm.
Well, if the banks are really strapped, how come there's so much building of new banks now? There's a bank on every corner there used to be a gas station.
Where?
Well, in California.
Centralia
in one place, and Everett in another place.
California. No, look, the fact that the banks aren't willing to make loans. I didn't say the banks were strapped. What I mean is banks aren't willing to lend if I do not find it profitable to lend into an economy where the ceiling is 12% at a time when the rate of inflation is 10 or 11% per year. What they will do is lend somewhere else. That's what they're doing. They can still make money, but they can't make it by lending it under those usury rates. They do some lending. When the prime rate goes up to 20%, which is the rate that banks will lend to the very best borrowers. Actually, they're starting to fudge with the prime rate. But it always tickles me when I can get a loan below prime, which I can. I'm a better credit risk than General Motors. Or even Chrysler. but the reason for that is banks will make some loans to established customers, consumer loans, because they want to maintain their reputation, goodwill in the community, and so on. But they're losing money on those loans. Okay, now, I think that the real grounds for alarm are things like this. That in the housing situation. One is that this demand for housing is increasingly based on two incomes per family. And that means a lot of people are getting close to the edge. Maybe it can be maintained, but the probability of you losing one income when you've got two is greater than the probability of losing your whole income when you've only got one. And then because it's harder to move and all sorts of things like that. So that's a danger. Another thing that I think is a danger is of populist legislation that is going to just make the whole thing worse. Some kind of legislative responses to this situation that don't understand the situation. For example, banks or savings and loan associations, which make housing loans, in order to protect themselves in a period of inflation, have tried a number of devices. Variable mortgage rates, where they say, look, what you do is you'll pay a mortgage rate that is regularly adjusted to take account of the rate of inflation, rather than we fix the mortgage interest rate now and it lasts for the next 25 years regardless of whether the rate of inflation goes up or down. Well, that strikes me as a good deal. Because I don't want to get locked into a long-term high interest rate when the rate of inflation is going to go down. But of course, here comes the next problem. The borrower never has been locked in. The borrower can always refinance. And so what the savings and loans have tried to do is trap the borrower a little bit. They've inserted due on sale clauses, for example, and prepayment penalties and so on. Now, these strike me as arrangements that people make. Do you know what I mean by due on sale clause? Colorado is one state that has recently, I think, had an initiative. Somebody here is from Colorado, or maybe didn't come.
I am, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, they had an initiative, and I think they passed it. I'm almost certain they did. Initiative or the legislature? You do have an initiative system, don't you, in Colorado, where people vote on? Well, anyway, whether it was the voters or the legislature, it was, I'm almost certain, passed in Colorado just this past year, a law that bans due-on-sale clauses. This means that the lender can no longer enforce a clause which says that when you sell your house, the entire proceeds become due and payable, entire loan. What by sticking that into the clause, what the lender is doing is making sure that he can make a new loan at a revised interest rate when you sell. You might ask, well, what do you care? You know, you're selling the house anyway. You're not going to have to pay the new and higher interest rate. And the answer is you care a great deal. Because if you can sell a house that carries, and it carries a 7% interest rate, 7% mortgage, and you can sell that to somebody who can go on paying off that mortgage, when otherwise he would have to borrow at 14%, you have, the value of your house has increased by maybe 100%. Figure it out. Do the little calculations. So what the law does is confer a windfall profit on all the people in Colorado who were fortunate enough to sign these due on sale clauses and get attractive interest rates as a result, and now have gotten the state to abrogate those contracts. But what it's going to mean in the future is less mortgage lending. And new devices by lenders lenders are going to jack up the interest rates. If they can't renegotiate the loan when the house is sold, then they're going to insist on a higher interest rate. And we trap ourselves with all kinds of things like this by not asking what next. Another thing that I'm very much worried about is, and I'm going to put it in big quotation marks. I'm going to wave my fingers here by the microphone to be sure that the quotation marks around the word environmental get recorded on the tape. Environmental legislation that affects housing developments. I'm not against environmental legislation, but I am very much against conspiracies by upper middle income suburban folk to maintain and increase the value of their homes by making sure that nobody with a lower income builds or locates anywhere near them. And that is what is happening in the name of environmentalism. It infuriates me. You can see it. If you just go and look at the records, it's perfectly transparent what is going on. People want to, after they get in, they want no homes on lots less than an acre. Of course, all of us are grandfathered. You know, we're in. We're saying, all right, my house is on 160 square feet, but that's okay. But now I'm in this area of mansions, and of course, the value of my little place is going to go shooting way up. It's just incredible what we are doing. And by the way, some genuine environmental legislation too. We're all in favor of pure water, open space, and green belts and all of that. We do not pay enough attention to who pays the cost of these things. An awful lot of these amenities, green belts and parkways and open space, are goods that are particularly appreciated by wealthy people. And the cost is paid largely by lower income people. We have really slowed down the rate of construction of moderate income new housing, and we have dried up the trickle-down upon which low-income people have always depended in our history for an augmentation of their stock of housing. I said the last time I said that to some group, I said, are you suggesting that poor people ought to be content with used housing? I have never lived in anything but a used house in my life. Used houses are not like used underwear.
It seems to me that that's a serious misrepresentation, because I think a lot of folks here will leave saying that it's environmentalists who are trapping poor people. And that's an awfully broad brush on the environmental.
Well, now I gee whiz.
When that same thing has been done for years and years with zoning legislation, which I think is a far more accurate way to depict that. Zoning legislation since the 50s has created a circle around the poor in the metropolitan areas and has been used as a tool against the poor, but it's not the environmentalists who have done that.
I don't know how I could... I thought my quotation marks were just...
At a time when environmental legislation is considered almost a conspiracy, which is another word you used, and a serious problem, especially during the Reagan administration, I think that's a very poor use of the term. I wouldn't use that word at all. The reason I used it
is because changes in zoning legislation now are overwhelmingly supported with environmentalist arguments.
But that's the advent of aesthetic zoning
approved
by the Supreme Court, and I still think it's a zoning problem, not an environmentalist problem.
Well,
be careful, that's all.
Yeah.
It's a caveat, a warning.
I was trying to be careful. I thought I was being careful.
My point is that it's not something new, that the same thing has been done with zoning legislation for years and years and years.
Yeah. But it's become much more effective in the last 10 years because of the environmental arguments that can be used in favor of it, because of a general belief. Well, look, the environmental impact statement, all by itself, has become an incredibly effective device in blocking any kind of change at all. And as I'm sure you know, the oil companies have recently discovered the environmental impact statement and have demanded that government file an environmental impact statement before it blocks them from doing certain things they want to do. In Seattle, my favorite case was when the school board decided to close down a school in the university district because there weren't very many kids there anymore. The embattled residents of the university district hit upon the device of the environmental impact statement and found that indeed, because the school board hadn't filed an environmental impact statement, it could be prevented from closing down the school. Now, that's not, I think, any defensible notion of environmentalism or protecting the environment. It's maybe more properly called zoning. But what I think it is essentially, is small groups of people increasing the value of their own property and engaged in a collusion, a conspiracy to increase the value of their own property at the expense of people that they probably don't think about very much, but who tend to be overwhelmingly low income.
Sure, but that's been done for years and years by different groups. Realtors used to tip neighborhoods by scaring people into believing blacks were going to move in.
Okay, all right, but I'm going to say again that it's much, much more effective in blocking the construction of housing now than it used to be. Okay, oh golly Moses. The other thing I would just mention is that because of it, the illusions that inflation creates with respect to rental prices, who's really gaining and losing? And inflation causes a lot of demand for rent controls, and rent controls tend to dry up the supply of low-income rental housing very rapidly, and that is provoking a crisis. So, I don't know. I wanted to get to ask the question, if inflation causes all these problems, how come we're having so much of it? Why don't we stop it? And let me suggest why we're having so much of it. I put some numbers up here. This is the simple mechanics of inflation. M here stands for the growth rate, the annual average growth rate over the period, this column of the 1960s and this column of the 1970s, of the money supply, measured in M2, which I think is the best measure. The money supply in the 1960s, if the average annual rate of increase was 7.1%, and as monetarists would predict, the average annual rate of growth of GNP, gross national product, was 7.3%. Monetarists say that over the long run, the rate of increase in gross national product is closely tied to the rate of increase in the money supply. But look what happened in the 1970s. The average rate of growth in the money supply was 10.3%. The average rate of growth in GNP was 10.2%. That's going to cause inflation. Why? Because here, the average rate of increase in real output in the 60s was a little over 4%, which was very good. That's well above the long-term historical trend, which is maybe about 3.5%, 3.3 to 3.5% in the U.S. Well, if you're increasing GNP by 7.3% and you're increasing real output by 4.1%, the rest of the increase in GNP is going to be an increase in the price level. It's a matter of logic. It's got to be. The percentage, because of arithmetic or mathematical problems with percentages, you can't quite add this to this and get this, but it'll all come close. When we stepped up the rate of increase in M, the money supply, in the 70s, and caused GNP to increase much faster, output did us a dirty trick, and the rate of growth went down closer to the long-term historical trend, and we got a lot of inflation. Now, why did we do that? Or some might ask, why did we do this? Why didn't we keep up our productivity? I don't know why we didn't keep up our productivity. There's so much argument about that that I'm not even sure what the questions are. I'm not even, tell you the truth, I'm not even sure that in any defensible sense productivity has declined. But I want to talk about quickly why we've increased the money supply so rapidly. I think there are three kinds of reasons. The basic reason is to finance deficits. Because the federal government has been running deficits, and when it runs a deficit, it has to borrow. When the federal government has to borrow, it goes to the same places you and I go, essentially. It goes to the banks and the insurance companies and says, buy our bonds. And that squeezes us out. Because the federal government is a better, a more secure borrower than we are. People would rather loan to the federal government than us. They're more sure of getting it back. So the federal government squeezes other people out. Home buyers, veterans, investors, and so on. And the Federal Reserve System, the central bank, in order to prevent that from happening, increases bank reserves so that banks can make more loans, and that, by a process I won't go into, but which is presented in all introductory economics courses, causes the money supply to grow. That's essentially it. That's how government deficits, that is how government deficits cause inflation, through creating credit squeezes that the central bank responds to by expanding bank reserves, which enables the banks to expand lending, which causes the money supply to grow. Again, if you want to know exactly how that happens, I assure you that what I've just said is completely non-controversial. Everybody agrees, rightly or wrongly, that that's the way it happens. The question now becomes, why did we have these big deficits? Well, it was to finance a war, for one thing. It was also to finance expanded domestic programs, for which we were not willing to raise taxes or couldn't raise taxes, that's it. Government spending expanded faster than government taxing. And I say, why'd they do that? Well, I've got some explanations for that. It's basically, I think, the way the democratic political process has come to work, that there's a bias in the system. What the government does, we see it operating right now with the attempt to cut the budget, cut expenditures. It's hard to cut expenditures because everybody in Congress can agree we ought to cut expenditures or not expand expenditures over here. But when it comes back to your district, that's a different story. And what happens is each little interest group manages to get to Washington and say, look, we're all in favor of budget cuts, but fellas, come on. Not ours, because we are well organized. There is, again, an enormous amount of literature supporting this view that it's just, there's a what the political scientists and economists call rational ignorance, where people only pay attention to their big interests and ignore the little interests, which they can't do anything about anyway. And the result is that government budgets are made up by yielding to a succession of special interest groups. And the budget just grows, and it grows faster than taxes can grow. A second reason for the deficits, I think, has been misguided fine-tuning. That is, the belief that we can stabilize the economy by adroitly manipulating the money supply. That has now pretty well been demolished. Again, very few people still believe that. Walter Heller of the University of Minnesota, which is home for most of you, I always find, who was the guy who coined the phrase fine-tuning and popularized it, has repented insofar as Walter Heller will ever repent. But he's admitted that, well, fine-tuning was oversold, and he was the chief overseller. So we just don't know enough. We do not know enough. It's kind of hubris we thought we could fine-tune. But there's a problem. When we tried, fine-tuning has an upward bias again for a very simple reason. When the money supply is in, when the rate of growth of the money supply is increased, the first effect is the good one. The first effect is on output. Output expands, and only later do prices start to rise. So if you want to give the economy a little upward goose, it pays off politically, because you get the benefits first, and the cost comes later. And you say, well, what about turning it down? Blast it. If you turn it down, once again, output is affected first. But now that's the cost, and that hurts. And it's only much later that prices start to fall. So we've got a policy instrument here that gives us the benefits early and the costs later when we're going up, and the costs early and the benefits late when we're coming down, and that's going to lead to a steady upward bias. How about the other thing? How about OPEC? Well, that was Carter's complaint, I call it. It's amazing to read the economic reports of the president over recent years. They're always talking about OPEC oil price increases. You know, if you've screwed up the economy, you got to find somebody to blame. And if OPEC hadn't existed, it would have had to be invented. But I don't believe it. I'm willing to argue with some people. But if you make some international comparisons, I do not think you can support the notion that OPEC caused inflation. It's just Germany, Switzerland, England, Italy are just four countries. I would challenge you to compare their dependence on foreign oil and their inflation rates with the United States' dependence on oil and United States' inflation rates, and it doesn't wash. What does happen, of course, is that OPEC-induced increases in oil prices do make it a little more difficult politically to maintain control of the money supply. It's easier, rather than forcing people to accept these higher prices without making more money available, you can just make more money available, and it seems to make it a little less painless. Well,
they're also not spending 25 to 35% of their revenues on defense either. Defense tends to be an extraordinarily unproductive, reintegrating amount of goods and services.
Who isn't? I don't understand.
Well, Italy, West Germany, Switzerland especially. Really, Switzerland has a pretty extensive defense, but it's not an offensive.
Okay, so you're saying that another cause for our
inflation
is the military spending. I don't think that can be supported at all by the data. I'd be happy to talk to that. I've got some data here for you to look at. But if you look at rates of change in defense spending and rates of change in inflation, you can't come up with any correlation. But I hate to say that dogmatically, but it won't do it. It's not the I'm not a fan of increased defense spending, but I think it's important. I think it is very important that we not blame problems on something because we don't like it. I am very unhappy with the current administration's stress on increased military expenditures. I'm very unhappy about that. I happen to think that reflects a terrible misconception of the United States' role in the world today. I mean, it's dangerous and it's wasteful, and I hope that I am not led, for that reason, then, to attribute to military spending all sorts of evils that, in fact, are.
Well, I'm not
else.
Lumping it all on that either, but I'm just saying that I happen to think that it is a factor increase in inflation.
Okay. Let's see. I've got to close my notes if I can quit in 2 minutes. What is to be done? There are two main schools of thought today. One I would call the orthodox monetarist, or the monetarist orthodoxy. Monetarists have sort of absorbed some of the Keynesians here, versus the supply-sider view. These are the two contending positions. There are, of course, a little minority positions, but the monetarists say, slow down the rate of growth of the money supply. That's the thing. And what about the budget deficit? They say, well, work on that. But the important thing is to slow down the rate of growth of the money supply. Do it gradually, because if you do things quickly, that causes disruptions. gradually slow it down. And, of course, bring the budget into line because it's going to make it a lot, into balance, because it'll make it a lot easier. The supply siders are arguing, no, cut taxes. And the monetarists then respond, my gosh, that's going to increase the deficit. And the supply siders are arguing the deficit isn't that important. And the monetarists say, well, but look, if you don't, if you run a big deficit, it's got to be financed. And if it's going to be financed, the Fed is going to increase the money supply, and that's going to cause inflation. And the supply siders say, no. If you cut taxes, that will so increase the supply of saving relative to consumption that there will be enough additional funds to borrow that borrowing can take place without an expansion of the money supply. And then the supply siders say, but even if that won't work, you know, you've got another fallback position, they say, in the long run, we can't control the money supply anyway. That the money supply in the long run really adjusts to the needs of trade. They're kind of going back to the old classical argument of two centuries ago, that the money supply, either the people discover new forms of money if trade demands it, or they simply circulate existing forms of money faster. And so the supply siders are arguing diddling with the money supply can cause a lot of problems, but in the long run, you don't stop inflation or make a healthy economy by choking down on the money supply. You do it by cutting taxes, especially marginal taxes, to provide additional incentive. Now, that's the argument that you've heard. Where does the truth lie? Well, I don't know where the truth lies anywhere, but on this one, I'll confess to being hopelessly confused. I'm usually persuaded by the argument or the article that I read last. let's go. Yes, sir.
Why does the government continually encourage deficit spending on the part of personal life? So for instance, permitting deduction of interest paid on mortgages or whatever else from your income tax, but on the other hand, not permitting you to, and not really encouraging savings by saying you're free to make as much as you want on interest, but tax-free. I mean, would be the result, wouldn't it? I mean, you'd increase your savings the same as Japan has a much increased rate, but we weren't always eating the seed corn.
You mustn't expect these policies to be rational. These policies, seriously, these policies came about, and you just look at those two policies, they come about as a result of different sets of political pressures. The mortgage interest deduction on the income tax is a clear response to the political power of homeowners, and people interested in the real estate business, building trades unions and so on. And there's no reason to expect that in a democratic polity to be compatible with all sorts of other policies.
Would it not, though, also have a great deal to do with reducing housing inflation if somebody knew they weren't going to have the government subsidize if they're in the 50% bracket, for instance, 50% of all the interest that they paid, wouldn't that?
Yeah.
They're out of pocket money.
I suppose it would. I don't know to what extent it would. On the other hand, you see, I've got another policy goal here. I think home ownership has been one of the fortunate blunders of our policy. I think that when the United States started subsidizing home ownership, it did a good thing. I think it did it usually as usual for the wrong reasons, but I do believe that neighborhoods in which people own their own houses are much more likely to be satisfactory neighborhoods than neighborhoods in which people rent. And I would like to see us find ways to put home ownership of some kind within the range of possibility for absolutely every family unit in the society. yes, sir.
It seems that the haves have the ability to find tax loopholes, tax shelters, and so on and so on. And whether you raise or lower the taxes, it doesn't make any difference. They'll escape it anyway. Whereas the middle people, they get stuck every turn of the road. Is there some way that that can be dealt with from a public policy?
Oh, boy. Yeah, you know, my bank says, advertises now, at last, a safe and secure hedge against inflation. Minimum deposits, $10,000. I I don't have anything to say to this except that I think it is good to remember that they're the able people, the ones who can play the system well, will be able to play almost any system. And we sometimes suppose that by moving from one set of rules to another set of rules, we will make it easier for the have-nots and harder for the haves. Sometimes we do, but I think more often what we do is make the game less satisfactory from everybody's point of view. Like, see, the rich aren't hurting. I think what the rich are doing, what the haves are doing in our society, is playing a lot of non-productive games, a lot of sterile games, doing as a result of often attempts to shift benefits and burdens around. I'm not saying let's not do anything. I said let's pay close attention to as what you call the loopholes. Recognize that the more complex our laws and our regulations get, the more closely and minutely we try to control economic life in a society of 225 million people, the more opportunities we create for accountants, lawyers, and the more we create a litigating society, a society where people live for the tax deduction. And I am myself bothered by the way in which every time I make a charitable contribution, I drop a record in a little folder called Taxes 1981. It bothers me that I don't think I ever miss. And how, well, I don't think that's good for me or. Yes, sir.
I was interested in your diagram of housing as opposed to inflation. Were you saying that, in your opinion now, that the boom is over and that housing now will continue to rise at the rate of inflation?
That's my prediction, unless we get some sharp change in the rate of inflation. By the way, notice what would happen if the rate of inflation suddenly slowed down? You know, what would that mean? These things are now overpriced. Their prices up here reflect the expectation of continued inflation at this rate. So we can get the other kind of thing, which would, ooh boy, wouldn't that make people unhappy? A sharp slowdown, let me put it this way. If, thank God, we are successful in slowing down the rate of inflation, we will cause a crisis for many homeowners.
That's being predicted by many right now, that we're on the brink.
So far, we, thank God, we haven't been very successful in slowing down the rate of inflation.
Wouldn't that be more of a speculative? Wouldn't be hurt, though, because if you slow down inflation, the price levels would basically hold, so it'd be the profit. You wouldn't.
No, they won't hold. If the rate of inflation goes down, then the ordinary person holding a house is going to find its value declining. The prices, the value of housing will decline. Now, if your only intention was to hold that house until you die, you will never have to take that capital loss. Your heirs will take it. So the more frequently you have to move, the harder it will be. But remember this, too. Your mortgage payments, which you counted on as being gradually diminished in real cost over the years, are going to start increasing in real cost. So you're going to find yourself pinched by your mortgage payments.
It would seem in that critical situation, though, that there's another ironic sort of check, and that is all of a sudden builders are more able to build more houses, more people are able to buy in, thereby by demand driving the price back up. At least that's the argument that one reads in many places, that if we don't have a high interest and a high inflation rate, more people are allowed to buy in. That somehow keeps costs up there anyway.
I think that what you said is the result of confusing two things. Let me try. What the economist calls a distinction between the demand and the quantity demanded. You see, if the effective price of new housing goes down, a greater quantity of it will be purchased. Now, it's very important to recognize that that doesn't represent an increase in the demand, that is, an increase in the willingness of people at any and all prices to purchase housing. Consequently, when the price of housing goes down, people will buy more housing, period. There's no further effect. I sometimes hear this argument.
Yeah. That's not to say then that less housing is available. If more people buy in, then there is less housing available, you have a squeeze.
No. If the price of housing falls, more will be purchased only if more is sold, which means that somehow or the other more has to be supplied.
Okay.
That's taken for granted. You can't have more purchased unless more is sold. Now, whether that comes out of just more rapid turning over of the housing stock, that's not what I have in mind. I don't think that's what you have in mind. We're talking about in effect, new housing. All right. A fall in that, the price of that will cause more new housing to be both supplied and purchased.
Okay.
But that will not have any further effects.
You mentioned that the landlords are taking it in the neck on the basis of cash flow, basically, from the rental costs. I understand that the big increase for landlords has been for homeowners since increased the inflated value of the land, plus the equity payoff, plus the special tax laws that allows them to depreciate on paper what they have been actually inflating in land value. And that's where the profit for that has been, not in the rents at all.
That's a hard one to respond to. Let me just say this. If you own an apartment building with, say, 20 low-income residential units, and the rents don't rise because you can't get it, or they impose rent controls, or for any reason, if you can try to maintain that as a residential rental building for low-income people, you will lose your shirt. All right? But there are other options. One thing that you can do is sell the building for some other purpose. Another thing you can do is convert it to condominiums. The land and building will not have any increased, any appreciated value from which you can make a profit unless there is some alternative use. And then that value will be the market price when somebody sees that alternative use and decides to turn the property to it. So what happens as a result of this is that a lot of formerly available low-income rental housing in the cities is getting converted into condominiums and cooperative, or simply being remodeled. You knock out the wall between two apartments and you create a luxury apartment. And so you double your costs and you quadruple your rents. And that way you sort of catch up with the market. Or you sell it for an apartment building. There are all sorts of ways. So what you're saying is true. There are profits to be made from ownership of residential real estate in congested areas of cities. But I'm afraid that much too heavy a percentage of those profits are found by converting the stuff out of residential housing use, which aggravates the problem I'm talking about.
People that occupy low-income housing are on, quote, fixed earnings, on a fixed salary, or on a subsidized
income. I don't have any figures, and I don't have a foggiest notion.
Because it seems to me those are most obviously people that are bludgeoned by the landlord selling out because he doesn't want to have them to pay more money, and they may not have the money to pay in the first place. And then when the place is shut down, and I have seen it happen in a lot of places, at home and in bigger cities, they have no place to go other than if they can get the money to move, they try to move someplace else and live in a lot less of a quality of life in terms of their housing. And I don't see how the proposed Reagan administration cutting of social services or subsidies in terms of rent subsidies is going to help at all that situation. You see what I'm trying to get at?
Well, I don't think it's going to help that situation at all. I don't see how it would.
It seems like
I also
all of us here are in a position to not have to worry about it, and that's fine. We have to think about where we're going to sit a few years from now, and in terms of our housing, our lifestyle, our financial gain. But it seems to me a lot of the economic policy that's being set in Washington is certainly the view and need of the majority, but the minority voice is getting displaced, and if not forgotten. If by that very fact, I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't agree with you about the majority determining the policy. I think policy is determined by succession of special interest groups. I think it's an important difference. But you're certainly correct that that certain groups don't. There's certain special interest groups that don't have much voice. Not every special interest group controls policy. I do think that the action here, the significant action, is much more at the local level than at Washington level. That whatever Washington has been doing or ceases doing is going to be much less important than what is done, can be done, has been done at the local level. And while it's true that most of us sitting here don't have to be concerned about that, we don't have to be. It is not true that all of us sitting here are not concerned about it. There are lots of people who are deeply concerned about it. I control some rental housing that I've leased out for refugees, and I'm very concerned about the rental housing market and getting trapped by all sorts of things and stupid. I just got notice from Kim. I would have to figure out some way to satisfy some stupid government mandated insurance regulation on this house or kick out a family of 11 Cambodians.
Yeah. Compare the case of the owner of an apartment that keeps his own ownership for over this period of inflation. And we're in Southern California, for example, where they're constantly changing. One guy sells for, he sells for $100,000, and the next person sells it for $200,000, next person sells for $400,000. That in itself is the reason for the rate increase in the rents, because the one that bought it for $400,000 and actually quadrupled the rent, where the person, if he kept it and never sold it, he wouldn't have to do it. Four times.
Yeah.
And if he does, he's really making a real windfall.
Okay, I want to first invite you to go to lunch if you want to, but then that's a very interesting question, and I think it represents a misunderstanding that's widespread, and I want to try to speak to.
Isn't it also induced by the fact that those persons that pay that higher price can have most of it subsidized by the government?
No. I don't. That's not true that people pay those higher prices and have most of it subsidized by the government. Look, let me back up. Look, and take California's Proposition 13 as a beautiful example. One of the ways in which the Proposition 13 proponents got that through was by pointing out that property taxes are a big component of rents. And therefore, if you cut property taxes by law, rents will go down. Well, I'm sure that the proponents of that really believed it. Jarvis clearly believed it, because Jarvis was furious and indignant when rents not only didn't fall, they rose after Proposition 13. That was just a very fundamental error in economic analysis, if you will. Property taxes do not affect the level of rents except in the long, long run. Look, think of it this way. Suppose that you own an apartment building. It's all constructed. Now, you're paying a certain amount of property taxes. I don't care what it is. You've got other costs. What's going to determine, let's suppose that you want to get maximum revenue out of the building, all right? What's going to determine what you can get? And the answer is demand, and that's all. Demand, what people are willing to pay for those units. Now that will be determined by their incomes, by how much other housing is available and all that, but it's demand that's going to determine the rents. Now let's suppose that the government doubles your property taxes. Can you raise your rents? Nope. Suppose the government cuts your property taxes in half. Will you have any incentive to lower your rents? Nope. Property taxes in the short run are completely irrelevant to rents. Those are costs that are that simply have no effect on the decision to rent out, whether you're a tenant or a landlord. You know, if the owners, if the apartment owners in California had cut rents, say 10% after Proposition 13, they would have been cutting rents below the market clearing price. And what would have happened, you have shortages, long queues,
very, very low vacancy rates. You wouldn't have been able to find apartments. And what would happen if people say, and then the bidding, normal bidding prices would have brought them right back up.
I wasn't speaking of property tax, I'm speaking in terms of the interest again on the loan that they made to buy the property, not the property tax.
It's the same, I'm sorry, but it's the same thing. It's the absolute same thing. Suppose that the bank tells you your mortgage rate is doubled. It doesn't make any difference. That's something that is not relevant to the price you're going to charge for those apartments. When it is, you know, it's proven that rents tend to be increased when buildings change hands. But that's not because the new owner has to get back his higher mortgage payments. What actually happens is that somebody sees that those rents are below market, makes an offer for the building that the owner, current owner, finds very attractive because he doesn't realize that he could raise his rents. He finds it very attractive. He sells the building. The new owner now sets the rents that he believes the market will bear. The causal relationship runs this way, typically. A new owner comes in and sees, hey, there is a building with rents below market, makes an offer to the owner, the building changes hands, and then he increases the rents. He does not do it to cover his higher mortgage costs. The proof of that would be, suppose it turns out that the building is in a very unattractive area. People just discovered this. You know, it's a, let's say suddenly there's an increase in crime. The demand collapses. He's going to have to lower his rents. Doesn't matter what his mortgage rates are. You cannot change, if you're renting out your basement or you're upstairs, you can't change that rent on the basis of changes in your mortgage rates or your principal payments or your property taxes or any of those things. You demand is going to determine it. That's you see, another tragedy, misunderstanding, because when rents didn't fall, and any economist would have predicted that they weren't going to fall, except in the long run, you see, in the long run, lower property taxes induce more people to construct apartment buildings.